And then I think there's a whole bunch of other sort of like tricks and ways of going about the work that are kind of uncommon within other philosophical writing or even other more kind of fictional or aesthetic writing or whatever it might be as well. And we've actually highlighted a few. And again, for our listeners, there are obviously aspects of Twilight of the Idols that we're touching on here in terms of themes, but we really want to make the show a little bit more about the sort of background mechanisms that elucidate the actual content and give it layering. On some level, we came to this conclusion because both of us have encountered online, but also in person, many people who I'll run into people, I'll be too mean or whatever, but I'll run into people who I know don't have a huge philosophical background, and they'll be like, "Oh, I'm just reading Thus Spoke Zarathustra or whatever," and it's good for them for trying, but I suspect that people get like one of the things to talk about actually very briefly is his writing ability, is his rhetoric ability, which tricks people into thinking that they get what he means. Or get the core of what's going on, because it's not like his works are. It's not like reading Nietzsche is it's not like reading Twilight. It's not like a super easy book, but it's certainly less turgid and insane than reading Being and Time or like Critique of Pure Reason, which is just like an absolute slog. They're well written, they're well organized. But again, he's pulling from all sorts of ancient cultural references, modern cultural references to him. It's important to remember as well that Nietzsche was a big fan of German opera in the late 19th century. That's where he spent a lot of his time. He was friends with lots of opera people. He hung around them. He wrote for them. He wrote reviews for them. And so us as readers, I'm not attending Wagner in Potsdam in, 1875, okay? Like, I'm not in that world, but Nietzsche writes for individuals who he expects to understand that kind of stuff. Now, I think one of the biggest ones that we picked out, there's many, but there's, first of all, maybe it's worth talking about aphorisms. In large part because the aphoristic, an aphorism is basically a short, pithy saying. And the aphorism aspect is really important to talk about because it's probably the most common way people encounter Nietzsche now, primarily online, is like I shared earlier, through aphorisms, through short little quotes. And just to read off some of his aphorisms here, he wrote, "The value of life cannot be assessed." That's aphorism. There's nothing else to that right now. "Whatever is does not become, whatever becomes is not." Another aphorism, another great one. Let's just see if I
Actually, that
jump
I
back.
want to. Is that an aphorism? Because I'm looking at. So I'm looking at my excerpts from Twilight of the Idols. That sentence, "That which is does not become, that which becomes is not." So, but this isn't a. Yeah. I wanted to say something about this, though, which is really interesting, which is important for approaching Nietzsche and not falling into sort of misunderstanding his aphorisms is, we're saying, okay, read him in context. He's got all, there's a before and after to everything that he says. Well, what about his aphorisms? Because those seem very self-contained. You will start to see that his aphorisms are actually connected to one another if you recognize the aphoristic character of the rest of his writing, right? So this is a really good example of that. That which is does not become. That which becomes is not. It's technically the concluding sentence of one of the paragraphs from the first section, quote unquote, Reason and Philosophy. Now, his writing, even in the midst of the rest of his prose, reads aphoristically, right? Because they feel like self-contained ideas, and that is true. But this should warn you about taking the aphorisms as too, self-contained or too self-isolated. they do have a relation to one another. The important thing to ask is, what is the relation of the aphorisms to one another, right? You can't just pick these up and contemplate them on their own. This is kind of a proof of that, because the stuff that isn't self-contained is also aphoristic. So aphorisms can be non-self-contained.
And then to jump into some self-contained ones, though, in his first section, Epigram and Eros, although I do think you're correct, the bravest of us only rarely have the bravery for what we actually know. So I think the point with the aphorism is it's not a statement in the sense of, like, it's not giving you information in the same sort of way that it's like a treatise or a paragraph or a section might try to be elucidated idea. The aphorisms are there to basically elucidate your own thinking, to literally look at something like this and be, even the bravest of us only rarely have bravery for what we actually know. What could that mean? It's a conduit to opening up new questions, right? And in that sort of organic space that Nietzsche is trying to create, I think there's some belief that people might come and find interesting new conclusions to things that are really just prompts. The modern take of Nietzsche, unfortunately, is to take these and then sort of use them as quotes. The most famous one, obviously, probably everybody would recognize this. This is from number 8 of the Twilight of Idols. What doesn't kill me makes me stronger. First off, we want to say that is an insane thing to say. If I get hit by a car and my legs are ripped off, but I survive, I couldn't imagine someone coming to me afterwards and being like, well, it didn't kill you, so it made you stronger. You can no longer walk now, though, and you have all sorts of other physical pain problems and stuff for the rest of your life, but it's made you stronger.
Yeah, I remember being in high school and trying to defend the profundity of that statement. There's obviously something to contemplate there, but the insanity of the actual assertion, yeah, is absolutely true.
But there's another part that comes up when we're talking about Nietzsche and how Nietzsche's ready, which is a lot of times these aphorisms are not complete when they're displayed, say, online or talking with YouTubers or whoever, right, whatever is going on. When you're not listening to the Canadian philosophy show where you get the real goods, which is the actual full quote is from life's military school. What doesn't kill me makes me stronger. So now we've got this component backing it up, or kind of in the foreground, from life's military school. So is that supposed to, is this now actually going about, you know, dealing with difficult times, getting through them, and how you can kind of grow from that? Or is it something like within the context of being in a militarized environment, being in a military school, being on all this kind of stuff, basically emphasizing that you need to be hard because, like, bad stuff is going to happen to you? And or ultimately, is it propaganda from a military school? Like, is the military school using this phrase within the context of their own school to be like, see, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger? Like, even though that's obviously patently false, these people are going to be running into, like, lines and lines of guys with guns and cannons and getting blown to bits. Obviously, it's not making them stronger. But is it effectively a kind of operating propaganda within the context of the school environment that he's writing about, right? And he leaves it intentionally unknown.
Yeah. Yeah, it's the aphorism, as you were saying, the aphorism kind of recovers a question. It's an answer to an unstated question, and it opens up a relation with the reader, because now the reader gets to ask, okay, well, what is going on here? What question is even being asked? Like, I didn't ask about a military school at all, and now I'm just being given this kind of perspective on life seen from, you know, a hard knock kind of perspective. What is Nietzsche trying to do by saying that one of the ways that life can present itself is in this militaristic way, and here's how to see it from that perspective?
I think it's probably worthwhile to talk a little bit more about, we got the aphorisms, to talk about some of the structural components going on, and particularly the one we wanted to focus on in the introduction. We found some examples in here that I thought was really revealing within Twilight, and revealing of how to read Nietzsche, the kind of little, there's definitely more that we're going to get through in this episode for readers. But hopefully you can kind of take some of these things with a new perspective if you go towards any of Nietzsche's works, and don't just read them at face value, or you'll be missing some critical stuff. The one that we both picked up on that we thought was super interesting was dissonance, consonance and dissonance, if you want to say a little bit about that.
Consonance and dissonance are terms in, I don't know what the study of sound would be. I guess sonic studies, or in any case, it's a term of music. When two notes are played, they have certain frequencies, and the relation between notes can produce a pleasant harmony, a pleasant relation between them, or they can produce a kind of clashing or unpleasant relation between them. So, for example, if you play an A and then you play an A sharp, that will give you like a kind of harsh resonance. But if you played two different notes that were farther apart, they would give you a sort of more smooth sound. And Nietzsche is specifically evoking those kinds of relations, right? Resonance is just the relation between them. Consonance is a pleasant relation, and dissonance is a relationship that you want, or that doesn't sound as pleasing. Now, the important thing here is there is a psychological component to consonance and dissonance. It's that all dissonance seeks resolution, right? All dissonance wants to move into consonance. So there's a kind of natural way that music flows. A good musician knows how to push the listener on through a piece, or kind of mold a different aesthetic by manipulating different kinds of dissonances in different modes and then resolving them in consonance.
Yeah, I was just going to say, to add on to that, in kind of layman terms, like I enjoy relatively often listening to, you know, the kind of classics of classical music, right? And if you listen enough, you can kind of, there's almost this expectation, like your head is putting its, your ears are going ahead of your head, and you're expecting a certain kind of resolution. You feel like you know where this piece by Vivaldi, where this piece by Mozart, or Philip Glass, or whoever it's going to be, you kind of know where it's going. You can sort of map it out before the sound has actually hit you, come through your ears.
Nietzsche wants to do something a little different. He wants to obviously use these. He's going to use consonance and dissonance, but he wants to never really settle within consonance, or he wants to put consonance in the service of dissonance. This is all, it's a bit abstract, and we'll get some text here in a second, but essentially what you'll see when we go into what we're going to be exploring, Nietzsche is going to arrive somewhere, and it's going to produce a kind of sense of satisfaction. We've arrived at a statement of Nietzsche, a belief he has, or some kind of immutable truth. That's the other thing too, is we need to understand the relation between consonance and dissonance and the ideas he's critiquing, right? That's how we'll get the philosophical cash value, right? The ideas of these eternal ideas of eternal truth, the immortal soul, and like God-given morality are supposed to be consonant. They're supposed to resolve questions about the way we conduct ourselves. They're kind of conceptually consonant, right? We can always just settle in them. And if we never arrive at any dissonance, then we'll always have a stable system. This also has to do with, you know, it's why Nietzsche is kind of anti-systematic as well. The thing that he'll be doing is constantly moving into a dissonant tone. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that he'll be harsh, but it means he'll push something, or not necessarily contradict himself, but kind of sabotage the expectations that he's set up, right? And this is in service of trying to introduce those conceptually dissonant things. So, like, the ideas that, well, the eternal truths that we have really came from somewhere. We haven't always had them. You know, the genealogy of morality, the evolution or the history of ideas, that the things that we think came from somewhere, and they're going to, because of that, they're going to disappear as well, and they're going to disappear into this consonance.
The state of becoming is a huge aspect, and I think, you know, I've got a piece here as we close. I know we've got 10 minutes left. This is a paragraph from the last section of the chapter, The Four Great Errors, because you said Nietzsche is very anti-systematic, right? Although not nihilistic, anti-nihilistic, very anti-systematic, which, as an aside, I want to say, you know, Nietzsche sometimes gets grouped in as being, you know, the philosopher of, you know, right-wing extremist groups and, you know, the Nazis and all this kind of stuff. His complete hatred of systemization, I think, would lead one to see how that's not really possible, and how extremist groups, to a fault, have this tendency to basically really over-engineer an ideological lens that they see the world through, and how they have to do that to justify their functionings and programs and ideas and stuff like that. And I think obviously Nietzsche would say that those people are, you know, living in some sort of bad faith. They're not actually they are deeply committed to a vision of the world that is really regimented and structured, and it's all kind of fake. And to add on to that, I wanted to read this last passage just before we come close to our end, and that I thought, out of everything I've read so far, encapsulates at least a little bit of what Nietzsche himself is looking towards. What can be our doctrine alone? So what can be our doctrine? Notice it doesn't say I, but our. That nobody gives human beings their qualities, neither God, nor society, nor their parents and their ancestors, nor they themselves. The nonsense of this last notion we are rejecting was taught by Kant and intelligible freedom, and maybe was already taught by Plato as well. This is the idea that, like, you know, the world actually emanates from the mind. Nobody is responsible for being here in the first place, for being constituted in such and such a way, for being in these circumstances, in this environment. The fatality of our essence cannot be separated from the fatality of all that was and will be. We are not the consequences of special intention, a will, a goal. We are not being used in an attempt to reach an ideal of humanity or an ideal of happiness or an ideal of morality. It is absurd to want to divert our essence towards some goal. We haven't invented the concept of goal. In reality, goals are absent. One is necessary. One is a piece of destiny. One belongs to the whole. One is the whole. There is nothing that could rule, measure, compare, judge, or being, for that would mean ruling, measuring, comparing, and judging the whole. So again, so what he says that would be mean of ruling, measuring, comparing, to judging the whole. He's talking about, like, about how we just have this innate tendency, just like with dissonance, to be like, okay, we found a void, we found an unknown, we're confronted with this, we need to organize it, we need to project ourselves onto this world and project it in such a way that now it makes sense to us, and we'll build up systems, and we'll build up social systems and hierarchies and da-da-da-da-da, and it all kind of goes on each other. But all of these things, Nietzsche would say, are you know, phantasms of our own existence. There is nothing that could rule, measure, compare, judge, or being, for the whole, meaning ruling, measuring, comparing, and judging the whole. But there is nothing outside the whole, that nobody is made responsible anymore, that no way of being may be traced back to a causa prima, the first cause, that the world is not a unity, either as sensorium or as spirit. Only this is the great liberation. In this way only, the innocence of becoming is restored. The concept of God was up to now the greatest objection against existence. We deny God, and in denying God, we deny responsibility. Only thus do we redeem the world. To read through that, my initial thought, from my reading so far, I felt like that was the best elucidation of what Nietzsche actually kind of thinks or believes, and within the context of what he's talking about with Twilight of the Idols. Certainly not a systematic system, but more or less a rejection of systems, rejection of subjective systems put on the world, and that any of these sorts of things that we do in society, in culture, in interaction with the natural world are, you know, our own fleeting impressions on that wider stage. But then we get sucked. We're so small, we get sucked into them, right? We get sucked in. We believe. We can't not believe. It's the way things are, right? And sometimes it takes, and Nietzsche is, well, we haven't touched a lot about this, but this is in the Twilight Vitals as well. You know, Nietzsche talks a lot about history, right? And the important part of history to talk about as well is that things change, and things change dramatically in terms of values. They change dramatically, you know, in terms of ways of thinking, of philosophical movements, of all this kind of stuff. So clearly all of these things, especially within the context of philosophy, which constantly seems to be looking for and espousing that they've found the truth, right? Like this is this, you guys, this ethical system that I've come up with, it's bulletproof. It's the one. And, you know, Nietzsche is always going to say that that's basically an anthropomorphic projection, and that like the world doesn't actually, you know, the forest and the trees and the waves and whatever it might be, they don't hear that.
And notice too, the movement from consonance to dissonance here that Nietzsche wants to try to sustain, this idea of taking these permanent ideas and not necessarily trying to substitute anything in their place by declaring like a nihilistic system, right? He's not saying that there is nothing there. It's just that, well, he is saying that there really is substantively, metaphysically, nothing there, but he's not replacing that with any other system. He's trying to hold open the possibility of void. Intellectually, that is the movement from the consonance to the dissonance, right? And he's trying to teach us to anticipate and almost appreciate that dissonance itself.
Why don't we just very briefly talk about maybe the only philosopher that Nietzsche like kind of liked, who was Heraclitus, and how we see a little bit of that. Like for me, it's been a little while since we've read Heraclitus. We've had a couple episodes going over him. For those of you who don't know, super ancient guy, pre-Plato, pre-Socrates, very little is known about him. But he had this idea, which is very prominent in Nietzsche, that like the world is at a constant sort of organic growth, and that the world is in constant flux and in tension with itself, right? You know, as things rise to prominence, their prominence only bespokes their fall, right? And it's only in tension, in these sorts of tensions, these growth, this kind of, as Heraclitus would say, this war, and Nietzsche would probably say this sort of war, that becoming is the thing that's happening.
Yeah, exactly. I will read the section that I have. I think it's excerpted. My anthology, I think, excerpts this section. This is section 2 from Twilight and the Idols, Reason and Philosophy. I set aside with great respect the name of Heraclitus. So this is, again, going back to this almost poetic reading of Nietzsche, we have to understand that this is in context. Nietzsche has been mocking. He's been verbally mocking and putting in scare quotes, you know, the Eleatics, the people who believe in being, who cannot accept that things become, the people who reject the senses. So he says, I set aside with great respect the name of Heraclitus. Here we have a kind of resolution to his mockery. He is going to praise Heraclitus. While the rest of the mass of philosophers were rejecting the testimony of their senses because they display plurality and change, he rejected the testimony of the senses because they displayed things as if they had duration and unity. Now he's building up for a dissonance here, because in the previous statement, he was saying these people are wrong for rejecting the senses. Now he says that he's going to respect Heraclitus, but he's already building up to saying that, wait, Heraclitus is also rejecting the senses. Heraclitus did not do justice to the senses either. So again, the tension is building. He agrees with Heraclitus and he has great respect for him, but he's going to build a tension with Heraclitus. They do not lie either in the way the Eleatics thought or in the way that he, Heraclitus, thought. They do not lie at all. What we make of their testimony is what first introduces the lie. For instance, the lies of unity, the lie of thinghood, of substance, of duration. Reason is what causes us to falsify the testimony of the senses. So he's rejecting Heraclitus and saying that, actually, I have a bone to pick with Heraclitus because he rejects the senses because they do display unity. But I say that the senses don't lie to us at all. The senses are what is true, right? It's how you verify things. If you want to know there's something in the box, you open the box and check with your eyes, right? So I disagree with Heraclitus, but Heraclitus will always be in the right for saying that being is an empty fiction. The apparent world is the only world. The true world is merely added to it by a lie. Now, this embodies something that Heraclitus talked about as well, which is agreement by disagreeing. So in a way, it shouldn't surprise us that Nietzsche is disagreeing with Heraclitus. In fact, that is his agreement with Heraclitus, because Heraclitus paradoxically says that, you know, they do not understand how disagreeing with itself, it agrees with itself, having a backstretched connection like that of the bow or the lyre. Nietzsche is setting up these constitutive tensions that Heraclitus is talking about by not ceding ground or just agreeing with Heraclitus. He is going to disagree with Heraclitus and in that way revive and make meaningful what Heraclitus is saying. It's paradoxical, but this is the way that Nietzsche is going to go about his entire text as well. Notice the movement from that consonant landing after the mockery of the philosophers into a, you know, a cordial agreement with Heraclitus. And then he mounts the criticism again. And then he says, and then he agrees with Heraclitus again. So it's this movement of consonance and dissonance. This is one way to read Nietzsche.
Please email us at hello@philosophyshow.ca. You can find the Canadian Philosophy Show at tcps.podbean.com and on Apple Podcasts and Spotify.
I'm Hale. You've been joined by Brandon, and we look forward to you joining us next week.